Hi, my name is Sean Kelly. I am 37 years old. This is January 24th, 2011. We're in Birmingham, Alabama, and I'm here with my longtime friend, Wade Kwan. And Wade, you and I went to high school together. That's how we got to know each other, but we didn't really become close friends until we shared the same job, or at least I took the job and you trained me on it and left me in that god-awful place.
That's right, and known each other for now 20 to 25 years. I'm 40 years old, almost from Birmingham, and I'm very excited that you could be here with me today. I know I dragged you into this, but I think this is going to be interesting.
So, so why me? Why did we end up picking me out of your close friends?
Part of it is, I mean, you know me pretty well. Part of it is, you know, you come from a journalism background, so you're used to asking questions of people all the time, even if they're uncomfortable questions. And one of the things I wanted to do is have someone around that I could trust. But, you know, also with the understanding that you really need to feel free to ask anything.
Okay. All right. So one of the things we talked about earlier, first, you're 40 this week. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
How are you feeling?
You know, I feel okay. It's it really is just a number, because you don't think about it that much. And if you somehow don't pay attention to it, like I managed to do, it just kind of slides on by. Normally, I think of this as like a milestone birthday, and as you know, it's just been kind of a normal, quiet, everyday week. We've been distracted by many things, and as it goes, it just kind of comes and goes. So, you know, there'll be celebrations and so on, but it feels like a normal birthday.
You told me earlier that you were starting to feel a little dragged down, that maybe you're coming down with something.
Yeah, it's you know, it's the middle of winter, and sometimes, you know, if I get worn out from a lot of activity or something, you know, I'll start to feel like something's coming on, and, you know, it might go away, or it might stick around, or it might get worse. And it usually happens around the wintertime. It usually happens about as it starts to get colder. That's why I'm glad we're in the South, because it doesn't get as cold as it could get elsewhere. But I'm not a fan of the cold, and sometimes I feel a little vulnerable to cold weather.
Yeah, that's one of the things we've talked about, kind of ironic. I'm the person with the chronic life-threatening disease, diabetes, and you have no chronic illness, but you spend more time, it seems like, retreating to your house to kind of, you know, nurse yourself back to health, and I hardly ever get sick.
Yeah, it's, you know, part of it's just introversion, but part of it's just, you know, I should take better care of myself, and, you know, when you cross that milestone age, you think about those things that you eat, and you think about your sleep, and you think about exercise, and you think, what am I not doing that I should be doing? And when I think about those things, you know, there's always room for improvement. But, you know, when I look back, you know, I think I'm okay, because, you know, I only tend to get sick once a year, but then it just hangs around. It doesn't just come and go, you know, in a day or two. It just kind of lingers sometimes, and that can be kind of challenging, because it's like, well, I've got enough energy to work, so I'll just keep working. But then it doesn't go away. It's not like it lays me up for you know, 3 days at a time, and then I'm all better.
You tend to cocoon yourself when you feel bad, right?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, fortunately, I work from home most of the time, so it's not that hard.
Mm-hmm. So how you treat yourself when you're feeling sick, how much of that has to do with the illness you had between your senior year in high school and freshman year in college? You came down with bacterial meningitis, is that right?
That's correct. You know, I'm not sure what the link is. I mean, it's something I never really thought about in terms of having a lingering effect. When I got out, I was all better, and you just assume you're done with it. But I've never really looked to study, you know, how does this affect you long term? Does it have lingering effects, or is it just something that goes away, like, you know, any, you know, sudden illness or something that might hit you and then you recover from it?
This was a big deal. You were 18 and just graduated pretty high in your class from a rigorous academic school. You were getting ready to go to Cornell in the fall. You're working at a grocery store, right?
Right. So
tell me about your life at that point. You were, you know, 18. Were you dating anyone? Just hanging out with friends? What were you doing that summer?
Well, it was, you know, it was a pretty unspecial summer. You know, as you mentioned, I just finished up high school, and you know, sometimes in your senior year, you tend to slack and you don't take as many classes or you take it easy. And my senior year was pretty intense because I had a lot of classes and had a senior piano recital and there was a lot going on. And so summer was kind of a time to unwind and just, you know, take it easy for a little bit because it had been, you know, it had been a challenging 4 years in high school. And since I was getting ready to go away to Cornell, I, you know, I took on a summer job just to earn a little bit of extra money. It was part-time, so it was not that big a deal. Spent some time hanging out with friends and just vegged out. And so I was, I'd been working at the grocery store. I hadn't had a lot of chance to spend time with friends because, of course, they were busy getting ready for college, too.
Which grocery store were you?
It was Food World. It's, it was over in Hoover where I grew up. And, you know, again, just nothing special. Just sat there in a bag of groceries most of the time or took out the trash or did whatever was needed of me.
So you had a lot of contact with people, though, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that was really my only contact with people. I mean, I'd hang out with friends every once in a while, but it was just such a for a lot of folks, they were just kind of either getting ready for college or having their last hurrah, so I didn't get to see them that much.
So what – take me through. It was a weekend when you fell ill?
Yeah, I you know, I normally worked, you know, just various days throughout the week, and over one weekend, I just started to, you know, feel sick, and, you know, I just had a fever, and, you know, I was feeling sluggish, and, you know, it was, by Monday, it seemed like it was getting serious enough that we needed to go at least just get it checked out. You know, my mom took me to the doc in the box, and if I recall correctly, it was Jimmy Blake, who was the doctor on call, who was also a councilman here in town, and, he checked me out, you know, he said, you know, it's probably just the flu, which is weird for the summer, but not completely unheard of. And he just said, you know, rest, fluids, and you'll be fine. So we just went home you know, decided to, you know, just rest and take his advice.
You're an only child?
Only child, yeah.
So it's just you and your parents. They had a small store here in town or a big store here in town?
Yeah, my mom basically had her own retail store for clothing and jewelry and accessories and so on. And my dad worked as a professor at the University of Montevallo, but of course it was summer, so he was off. Mm-hmm. So either he was helping out with my mom or, you know, relieving her while she, you know, stayed at home. But essentially that's what they were doing.
So did they stay home, one of them stay home with you and the other go to the store? Or did you get, you know, stay at home by yourself? Or?
Well, so... You know, we went to the Dunkin' the Box on Monday since we had to wait till they were open. And so, you know, essentially my mom was already home anyway. But what happened on that Monday was I just started getting rapidly worse. My fever started to skyrocket and I was starting to feel weak. And, you know, I remember being on the living room floor. I mean, I couldn't make it to the couch. I couldn't make it to my bed. The most comfortable place for me was just to stay right where I was. I was lying down and, you know, I had the chills, but I had like 104 degree fever. I couldn't keep anything down. And it got to the point where, you know, as I was lying down, you know, lifting my head to take a sip of water was just about impossible. So at that point, they started to realize this is not just the flu.
Where did they take you? Did you go to an emergency room or?
Well, what happened was, so Tuesday, the next day, you know, my fever had really started to spike. I mean, they were putting cold compresses and it wasn't doing anything. So we went back to the Donk in the Box, and the first thing they did was call the ambulance. And so I remember being loaded into the ambulance. I remember, you know, my mom was following in the car behind me, except that, of course, I think she beat us to the hospital. It's the first and only time, thank goodness, that I've ever been in an ambulance, and they were running the sirens. And so now I'm starting to pick up that this might be not the flu.
What were you thinking about then? I mean, what was the what was for you? I mean, were you just consumed by the pain, or were you actually thinking about, you know, this is serious, this is dangerous, this is?
It was really a fog at that point, and part of the story just comes from anecdotes from everyone who was around me at that point. You know, they got me to Brookwood Hospital, and they put me in the ER, and. I remember a couple of things. One was that I was freezing cold, and they stuck this big, heavy blanket on me, but they didn't unfold it. And I, of course, didn't have the strength to unfold it myself. And it was a kind of a dark, quiet room, so they had me isolated, which turned out to be a good thing. You know, I was still throwing up, just couldn't keep anything down. I was getting dehydrated, and at some point during, you know, that, and it could have been 10 minutes, it could have been 3 hours. I'm not entirely certain, but during that time I was in that room, they gave me a spinal tap, which even in my semi-delirious state was really, really unpleasant. I remember kind of being curled up and on my side and, you know, being told not to move at all. And, you know, the thing is, I don't remember feeling anything other than my own sickness and weakness. So,
do you know much about bacterial meningitis now? You know anything about it?
Very little.
Well, it's
very little.
It's basically meningitis is a swelling of the membranes around the spinal column and the brain. And it can be triggered by a couple of things. It can be triggered, as in your case, by bacteria. That's probably the most common and most dangerous. It can be triggered by a virus, or it can even be triggered by a fungus. It is commonly, bacterial meningitis is commonly considered a young adult illness. It tends to pass itself around when young adults are in contact in dorms or in colleges or, you know, in close living quarters. Children tend to get a pass from it because they tend to be inoculated against it. And it's about the point where young adults are start congregating together that the inoculations wear off. So that's, you know, it's not really actually that big of a surprise that you got it at the age you did, and other than the fact you weren't, you know, already in college or living in a dorm or something like that. But it can be a very fatal disease or fatal illness.
And, you know, this was 1989, and nowadays you tend to see more about it in terms of prevention or just, you know, outbreaks on campus and so on. I think my case might have been one in a million, given the fact that we never did trace back where it might have come from. No one around me had it, fortunately. But we were never quite certain how I got it, other than I worked in a public place, and maybe that's where I picked it up in passing.
So I'd like to ask you to go back for just a little bit and help Sean. He was there. He knew you in high school. But help him remember what you were like then. Describe yourself.
I was not too unlike what I was now. We're going way back at this point.
Deep regression.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
think back.
Woo. Well, and part of it is, before all of this, you know, maybe I was slightly different than after it. Before, you know, I was bright-eyed. I was looking ahead to college. I was excited about this new challenge. You know, I knew I was going to miss my friends because, you know, I was the only one going to that particular school. You know, it's hardworking and
were you shy?
Sarcastic.
When you were 18, were you shy?
I think I'm always shy. I think shyness is something that I've overcome better and better over the years. But the reason why I felt safe or more outgoing in our high school was just because it was such a small high school. And I think that's why it's funny that we didn't know each other that well in high school. We knew each other.
Right. Well, it's fun. You know, irony for me is that you got up basically a social illness, and you are very, you know, a very shy person. I'm the opposite. It's one of the interesting things about our friendship is that I'm outgoing. I don't have a problem in a crowd. I actually have probably more problems one-on-one than I do in big groups, where you tend to, again, cocoon yourself a little bit when you're around a group of people that you don't know well.
Sure.
So you spent this week, a week in the hospital?
Yeah. So, you know, they did the spinal tap, and at some point they moved me to ICU. And this is where the story gets extremely fuzzy, because I was in so much pain that I basically came in and out of consciousness. And so I only have vague flashes of the first 2 or 3 days in ICU. They put a mask on me to prevent, you know, whatever it might be from getting out there, because they had no idea what it was at the time. And they were pumping me full of IV fluids because I was dehydrated, and they were putting in antibiotics into the IV bags. But I just remember I was in a hospital bed. I was getting round-the-clock attention. And it was just, it was excruciating. I mean, it was, being awake was way worse than being passed out.
Tell me about your parents' reaction during this period. I mean, were they scared, I assume?
They must have been, because they never left my side. And, of course, you know, I fortunately had no presence of mind to know what really was going on. I mean, yeah, I'm in the hospital, but I'm just so out of it. I just could not be plugged into it, and I think that might have been a good thing. But my parents, who, of course, you know, the doctor tells them, we have no idea what it is. We don't know what's going on. He's still got a fever. He's got weird bruise marks on his body. You know, he can't move. He's severely dehydrated. And so what do? You just sit there and you wait. And you know, my family's not a religious family. So what do in that point? Do you continue to pray anyway, or beg, or what? But I do know that, you know, no matter what happened, they were there the whole time. And remember that this all happened relatively suddenly. So, you know, anyone else that I knew probably had zero idea what was going on.
So by the end of the week, you began to rally? You recovered?
Well,
started to recover? Or?
I know that eventually they moved me out of ICU and into a, you know, a private room for obvious reasons. And thankfully, they made everyone else wear hospital masks when they came to visit me, which was an odd sight, but it was better than me wearing it because I was still vomiting all the time, and having to get the mask out of the way when you had to throw up was not pleasant. So, you know, I was strapped to about, you know, 5 or 6 monitors and just kind of lying there in my hospital bed, just kind of trying to sort out everything. And by that point, you know, I think my parents had called at least a couple of my friends just to let them know what was going on. And, but I was still, you know, trying to get back to a point where I could think straight and talk to people and respond.
Who were your friends that came to the hospital?
Let's see. If I remember correctly, you know, I think Clark came by.
Clark's a doctor now, right?
Yeah. And he always wanted to be a doctor. So it was a good case study for him. I know Andrea came by, and you know, a few people came by, and bless them for coming by, because I mean, realistically, they were probably putting themselves at severe risk. I mean, I was glad to see him, but had I known what was going on, I would have probably said, just stay the hell away, because it ain't worth it. And of course, you know,
kind of makes you think of E.T. and the men in the spacesuits and the.
It was like that. I mean, every. You know, like clockwork, a nurse would come in, change the IV bag, but they were always constantly drawing blood from me. And the challenge for any skilled nurse is when you're dehydrated, it's just about impossible to hit a vein. And when you've been pricked, you know, 30 times in the last 3 days, it gets really hard. And
it's a wonder. I mean, you give blood every 8 weeks. It's a wonder after that experience that you let anyone near you with a needle.
It took 9/11 for me to go get blood, but we'll come back to that. One thing I remember is, I mean, when they're changing the IV bags and they're drawing blood, they're doing it 24 hours a day. So at 3 in the morning, when I'm already having trouble falling asleep because I can't move because the chest monitors are on me, so I'm face upward the whole time. And so if someone forgets to turn off the lights, it's really hard to, like, turn over and go to sleep because you can't. And about that time, you know, a nurse will come in and draw blood. So one of the trainee nurses came in with a mentor and stuck me about 10 to 15 times trying to find a vein. And I think one of them had the presence of mind to say at some point, "Are you in a lot of pain?" And all I could do was just kind of nod my head. I'm not typically one to complain, and, you know, relatively speaking, that pain was okay. But eventually the mentor took mercy on me and drew the blood herself, but they were running a lot of blood tests. The other thing I remember was this might have been probably the last day of ICU, but at some point a doctor said, you know, you're in pain. Would you like some morphine? And of course, I nodded my head yes, because I thought that would be a big help. And what happened was, I don't know if you've had to deal with morphine before, but
only recreationally.
Well, I don't know how people get addicted to this stuff, because what happened was they jammed probably the biggest needle I've ever seen into the side of my leg, and I immediately was no longer in pain all over my body, because all I could focus on was the gigantic, humongous, never-before-felt pain in the side of my leg. And for the rest of my stay in the hospital, I never asked for morphine again. It just was not worth it.
Did your parents have medical insurance?
Yes.
Through your dad, I assume?
Yes, and the bill, all told, was $20,000, which in 1989, for the school I was going to, was a year's worth of tuition, and it ended up costing us whatever the deductible was.
Wow.
So, Wade, I want to ask, so, you know, you have this horrible experience in the hospital and drifting in and out of consciousness, but finally when you're lucid and you're out, how do you find that this experience has changed you?
Well, I'd never had anything even close to that happen in my life. I mean, I've never had a broken bone. I've never had anything worse than, you know, chicken pox. I didn't intend to fall into these kinds of situations. And I mean, so, you know, when you have a near-death experience at 18, and I say near-death not lightly, because they told me as they were taking me out that, out of the hospital, that had they not brought me in, I was probably about 10 hours away from death. A lot of teenagers never face anything like that. And I mean, you know, when you're out of high school and you've got everything before you, and all of a sudden, in a week, it almost just goes away just by random chance, you know. For me, it was, I really wanted to make the most of everything beyond that point, because, you know, when you're growing up, you tend to just fritter away a lot of stuff. And, you know, even someone like me who spent a lot of time studying and hitting the books and, you know, practicing piano and so on, I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do out there? How am I going to make the world a better place? Because, you know, there's no guarantee that the next time it won't take you out completely. And so I learned to appreciate things a little bit more. I think it's a hoary cliche, but it's probably one of the best things to ever happen to me, because until you go through something like that, you don't really appreciate everything that you have around you.
So those were the questions you asked, but what answers did you start to come up with as an 18-year-old?
Well, you know, at the time I was still wanting to go into journalism and be a writer. And I think that just kind of renewed my drive in doing that. You know, if you survive something like that, you don't feel like there's a lot that can hold you back at that point. And you don't worry about, you know, embarrassment or risk as much. You know, as Sean has alluded to, you know, I'm a private person and I keep to myself. And, you know, it was definitely a wake-up call. I don't know if I can put exactly into words, you know, how it changed me completely. And it took some time to kind of realize what had been going on and just how damn lucky I was. Because, you know, when they were wheeling me out of the hospital a week later, that was when they had figured out what was going on. It took so long for the lab tests. They were guessing the whole week. I mean, that's how lucky I was they just guessed it might be meningococcema, which is what I had. And so when they were throwing every antibiotic at me round the clock, they just magically hit the bullseye.
Well, let me ask you a question. This is somewhere you and I are also different on. I grew up in a Christian family, a very religious family. It's natural when you go through an event like that, at least in my tradition, to thank God. You know, a couple thousand years ago, it had been natural to kill one of the lambs and offer up a sacrifice and thanks. What did you do? I mean, what did your parents do? Was there you know, a moment where you thought about God differently or considered the possibility of God? Was, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I thank God when I find my iPod these days, but,
Did you find your iPod?
I found my iPod. Okay.
Thank God.
Yeah.
I know my parents did not have a religious conversion, and you know it's funny when you grow up in the buckle of the Bible Belt, you are steeped in church and religion, and most of my friends had attended church regularly, had grown up in the tradition. For me, I'm still wrestling with it. I mean, I wish I had better answers than I had then, and even after the tepid exploration that I've done over the years, I don't know. I mean, I'm just, part of me wants to believe, part of me that wants to believe in bigger things and the unknown wants to believe it, but at the same time, the skeptic in me, which has served so well in journalism, is terrible in terms of poking holes into everything.
For a few years after this, you were still close with your parents. Did you guys talk about that event much?
Not really. And I think the reason why is because it was so self-contained. I had to explain to friends of mine after I got out of the hospital what had happened because for some of them who, you know, just didn't know, you know, I was perfectly healthy by the time I got out of the hospital. I could walk around. There were no signs of it. There were no scars. You know, it wasn't like I'd broken my arm and I had to wear a cast for the next 8 weeks. I suddenly got sick. I went to the hospital. I got out, and I was fine.
No, nobody was there to sign your needle marks from the
exactly. It's so, you know, it wasn't something that needed to be talked about because it was a one in a million thing. Like, it would never happen again. So there was nothing to do to prevent it other than live in a bubble. And it just, it didn't come up with my parents. It didn't come up with friends. It just was one of those, like, that was weird.
This makes me think of my family, where there are certain members of my family that obsess over every medical event of their life, no matter how minor they are. But they talk about them publicly regularly. Their goiter, or their arthritis is flaring up, or their insignificant hangnail has caused them undue hardship. And it's funny because none of these events seem to be life-threatening, but every medical event in their lives is an opportunity to gather sympathy and discuss the mortality. And you actually had an experience where mortality was in play. And it's fascinating to me. I have, you know, like I said, I have diabetes. I've been on insulin for 10 or 11 years. I've, you know, broken some bones, but I've never been in a place where I've had to really reflect on my mortality. Long-term, I have to reflect on it because my father died when he was 59. My grandfather died when he was 57. I'm pulling for 61. I think, you know, if I can get an extra couple of years. And so, you know, with two young children and a wife, I think about, okay, well, what will I make it through? But I haven't, you know, I haven't had that instant where death was there waiting for me and I managed to get by him and had to reflect.
No close calls in traffic. No situations where you thought, had not a split second later something else had happened, you would be dead.
Yeah, but I suspect that I've had quite a few of those moments lately with all the ice and snow we've had. I've slid around a few times, but I've never been in a hospital longer than a couple minutes, you know, other than to see people. So I've never had an emergency that was medically related that scared me. I guess there have been a few times in traffic where I've been you know, very grateful that I managed not to get entangled, but nothing that comes close to mind that has altered my life or even impacted it for very long.
Well, you know, I still kind of have a little phobia about hospitals, and I think I might have seen the doctor maybe twice during that entire week. I saw nurses the entire time, and they were very thoughtful and took great care of me. And, you know, it was definitely one of the worst weeks of my life. But at the same time, I mean, they did their job and they did it exceptionally well because I'm still sitting here talking to you.
Are you you go have a physical every couple of years? You're pretty regular about seeking medical attention when you're sick, right?
Well, I get a physical every couple of years. You know, I go get blood routinely, so, you know, there's no surprises there. But if I get sick, I tend to just blow off the doctor. I just tend to think, I'll get better. You know, I'll just take it easy or, you know, I'll take some aspirin or something. But I only tend to go to the doctor if it gets to be what I think is serious.
You don't feel a little bit invincible after your meningitis experience, do you?
Absolutely not. I mean, one of the reasons why I try and take care of myself, at least, you know, in terms of what I eat and trying to get some regular sleep is just because, you know, I do want to live a long time. I do want to make the most of my life. And there are always things to be doing better, but it's not something where I don't necessarily obsess over my health.
Wade, now might actually be a good time to ask you, can you tell Sean how your life, especially since you just had a birthday, how has your life been different so far from what your 18-year-old self expected?
I think I changed a lot in the years after college. And I think I've changed, I mean, I think there have been phases where I've just kind of, I don't know how to put it exactly because, I mean, I don't want to say mature because, you know, the first thing that my freshman year roommates noticed in college was that they thought I was a sophomore because I was so reserved and, you know, didn't run around crazy like a lot of the freshmen did. It's hard to say. I mean, how have I changed?
What did you expect to be when you were 18? What did you expect to do? Did you expect to stay in Birmingham? Did you expect to go work for the New York Times? What were your expectations?
I expected that I was going to climb up through the ranks of newspapers, and it would probably be somewhere other than Birmingham simply because, you know, in terms of moving up, you want to go to bigger and better papers. But it wasn't because I didn't love Birmingham. It was just because, you know, I knew that I might have to go elsewhere to seek different opportunities. And, you know, one of the things that just kind of changed around us was just that newspapers aren't thriving as much as they used to. And so as some of those avenues closed, you know, I adapted and started to do other things for my career. But
what about personally? I mean, did you expect to be married?
Absolutely.
Have kids?
I thought I'd be married by 30. I thought I'd be married, you know, maybe even before that. And that, I think, has been very challenging for me because, you know, I have these dreams of getting married and having a family. And you wonder, you know, at this point, well, okay, is that still something that's going to happen? And how is it going to happen? And, you know, what do I need to do? And so on. And you know, it's frustrating because, I mean, most of my friends are married or in long-term relationships, and some of them have children, and I'm very...
Some have been in three or four marriages.
Absolutely. And, I mean, I'm very happy for them, but at the same time, I'm a little bit sad for myself.
Mm-hmm. So then, with that in mind, is there anything that you would do differently over the course of the life you've lived so far?
I don't think so. I mean, I like who I am now, and I know that who I am now is a product of everything that I've been through, for good or for bad. It's not healthy, and it's not productive to look back and think where you would have taken different paths. You know, I have to own my mistakes and learn from them as best I can.
We talked about a number of different topics before we got here to have this conversation about. You kept coming back to this one topic. You've lived an interesting life. You've interviewed hundreds of people. You've written some pretty damn interesting stories. You've been a minor local celebrity on and off. You know, we've got, you and I have some interesting shared experience. Why does this one experience, this brief hospital stay when you were 18 years old, why did it keep resurfacing as the story?
It's so far out of the norm for me. I mean, I've never been in a hospital again. Only maybe once or twice have I had those minor near-death experiences. And I think it was kind of like, this is your wake-up call for the rest of your life. If it had happened at age 10, I don't think it would have really made much of a difference. If it happened later on, I don't think it would have made much of a difference. You know, if it was God's will, as it were, you know, that was the time where I need to get out of my hazy dream of, you know, this is all about me and this is what I'm going to do next and this is how I'm going to beat the world, and at least have a wider perspective of what's going on around me and how insignificant I am in that grand scheme of things if I just slide on by.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad that you made it through that week. We became good friends later. I owe at least a portion of my lousy career to you for introducing me to that. You were at my wedding. You've been at both the baptisms of both my kids. You were there when my father died to be with my family, even though I was halfway around the world. So, you know, I'm very grateful that you survived that brush with death.
Yeah, it's something I would, as significant as it was, I would not wish it upon even my worst enemy.
Wait, I want to ask, so you've done a lot of things after that experience that I imagine you're proud of. So what, can you talk to Sean a little about one of the things you're most proud of with this new life you were given?
One of the things I'm most proud of, and it does involve Sean, and it's a story for another day, is we've managed to do some service projects on the Gulf Coast after Katrina in 2005. And the people that we met who have had to endure more than any of us will probably ever have to, the things that we get to experience together, even that small difference, I think, has had a major impact on both of our lives. And if I've done nothing else, that's probably one of the most significant things I've ever been a part of. And I'm very grateful for the fact that I'm around to be able to do something like that. And all it was just, you know, taking down some moldy boards and some flooded houses and, you know, distributing food at a food center. It wasn't anything other than just lending a hand in a really bad situation.
Why was that important to you?
I think it was important just because, you know, I think of us as neighbors. You know, we're here in Birmingham and down in New Orleans, you know, and down in Biloxi and Mobile. I mean, these are friends and neighbors. We spend a lot of time down on the Gulf Coast, and when they needed us most, we needed to be neighborly and to help them out any way we could. So we got together. We got donations. We got supplies. Sean graciously loaded his pickup truck with, you know, me, him, and two other volunteers and a ton of supplies and our own gear, and drove us down there so we could make sure that they were getting it. He's made several runs down there to help out and to assess the situation and a report on it. And it was pretty much the very least that we could do.
And then I want to ask one more question. You mentioned earlier that, jokingly perhaps, that it took 9/11 for you to give blood. Did you want to say something else about that?
Well, other than the fact that I was unqualified to give blood because of my weight, that I went and checked again after, you know, there's not a lot you can do about a terrorist attack 1,000 miles away, and so you feel like you got to do something, and so I went and checked again. Of course, at that point, I had qualified, so I just went and gave blood, and, you know, just gave blood ever since. Because, I mean, whenever there's a national crisis, you know, people will step forward and do those things. But then, you know, as the crisis fades, they tend to stop doing it. But giving blood is pretty much the easiest thing anyone can do. It's, you know, it's a half hour to an hour out of your day. And
It's every 8 weeks for you, right?
Pretty much like every 8 weeks. They're tired of seeing me at the donation center.
Do they ever miss your vein?
No, fortunately they're pretty good about hitting it these days. I'm fully hydrated, so.
All right, excellent. So what's, you know, now that you're 40, what's next for you, Wade? What do you think about long term right now? I mean, there are lots of lines of demarcation in your life from an age standpoint. There's, you know, probably becoming a teenager, graduating from high school, being able to legally drink. 40 is a big one. Can you think back of where you were at 18? And now that you're 40, what do you think's next for you?
You know, I think I'm still sorting it out as I go along. I mean, I'm going to continue to write. I'm going to continue to tell stories. I'm going to continue to search for ways to build a family. But I also need to appreciate what I have around me and know that wherever I'm headed, I'm still in a good spot where I am right now.
Thank you. Thank you. That was great.
Thanks, Sean. I appreciate it.
All right.